Welcome to the Angus Table, the podcast from Angus Australia. I'm Scott Wright, the CEO at Angus Australia. Each episode will bring conversations with breeders, industry leaders, innovators, insights, stories and ideas that matter and hopefully add value to your Angus operation. Whether it's genetics, markets, pasture management, marketing experts or people shaping the breed, this is where the Angus community pulls up a chair at the Angus Table. Thanks for joining us. Welcome to the Angus Table. This week we have a very interesting guest along with us this morning. A privilege to have John Condon join us from Beef Central. And I guess today we're going to interview the interviewer. And it's not often, John, that you'd be on this side of the table. Welcome along.
Yes, thanks, Scott. It's great to be with you. Now, I'm not sure if I'm really comfortable with this. As you say, normally I'm the one firing the questions, so you're going to have to excuse me if I start turning the tables on you halfway through.
Oh, no, it'll be fantastic. And you're very well known to our members. We've got about 4,000 members around Australia. There's more people than that, but it's just memberships, about 3,000 commercial members, 1,000 seed stock. And you would have a lot of those look at your publication of an afternoon and when they want to know the good oil of what's going on in the beef industry. So your name is quite familiar. And we've had some good interactions over the time since I've been CEO. John, as well, you've always been supportive of the industry in Angus times we've had good discussions, so especially coming up to the World Angus Forum this year. So
Look, it's been fascinating to watch the trajectory that the Angus breed and your society have taken over the period that I've been active in rural journalism, and you know what an incredible success story it's been.
Fantastic. Well, good to have you here, and it'll be great to drill into a bit of your career, John. And I guess good question is, I heard a whisper that you might be heading for a nice bit of acknowledgement this week for your career in journalism. Tell us about your background and how did you, I guess, become one of, if not the leading beef journalist in Australia?
So I suppose I was sort of preordained to do what I'm currently doing. I was born and bred in the Northern Territory. My family built and operated an export beef abattoir in Katherine for 20-odd years from the early 1960s. We also had a cattle property over in the Kimberley on the Gibb River Road, a place called Drysdale River, which we operated independently from our meat processing business. So I've sort of been waving into the meat and livestock industry all my life. So I came away to boarding school, as many kids in the bush do, and came to Brisbane, stayed on and did my university degree in Brisbane, and literally got recruited while I was finishing the last few days of my study by Queensland Country Life, Malcolm McCosker. And I knew I was going to end up in agriculture somewhere. I wasn't quite sure where that might be. I originally thought it might have been in policy and in advocacy, but I was interested in the journalism profession and felt always that I was a natural communicator, at least in written form. Not so much in my using my voice, but I always enjoyed stringing words together. And joined Queensland Country Life. I had a very happy 20-year career at Queensland Country Life. I was the national beef reporter there for basically the back half of my career. And then things started to change around 2010. My business partner, James Nation, and I started sizing up opportunities to do something independently. And that led to the establishment of our Beef Central business today.
Yeah, fantastic. Did you ever feel the twitch to go back into production agriculture, John, or have you been comfortable in journalism?
I like air conditioning too much, Scott. That's my problem. Look, no, I don't think so. I don't think I was ever destined to be a beef producer per se, but I very much enjoy my engagement with the beef production sector, but have no great yearning to actually, apart from having a few AA co-shares like most of us do, you know, I don't have any great yearning to be directly engaged in the industry myself.
Okay. No, fantastic. Well, you've certainly done very well reporting on the beef industry. How did you come to get Beef Central started? So we've chatted privately at times.
Yep.
It's quite a story, really. What? It's a bit of a 90-degree bend in the road.
Yeah. Well, I came out of an industry which, based on print media, which every state in Australia had a singular agricultural weekly publication, with the exception of Victoria, where there was a couple. But there was a single weekly newspaper produced in each state, and had been the case for 50, 60, 80 years. Of course, there was always the ABC Rural Department, which provided a radio service in that field. But as the internet started to emerge in the late 2000s, early 2010s, it became evident that there was opportunity to do something in a digital format as opposed to print. The problem with print, as well, one of many problems, but one of the key problems is the enormous distribution challenge. Once you've printed a newspaper, it takes forever to get it out to remote parts of the nation where your constituents basically live. In the case of Queensland Country Life, it was printed on a Wednesday night. The people in Brisbane got their paper on a Thursday morning. But when you start getting into remote areas, Boolya, Baduri, Birdsville, it wasn't at all uncommon for those people not to see their weekly news until the following Monday or Tuesday. And that often aligned with mail delivery services and things like that. So people tolerated a news feed which was incredibly out of date by the time they got it in a lot of cases. Internet started to emerge. I found my employers did not have a great appetite to engage in the digital space for one key reason. Whatever they would do in the digital space was going to impact negatively on their printed product. I think there was a genuine belief that anything in the internet was going to be a fad in terms of news distribution. James and I felt somewhat otherwise, and we started sizing up the potential to deliver a national, commodity-specific, as in beef-only, news service to readers via the internet. Early on, we weren't convinced that there was enough primary producers and beef producers who were, number one, internet savvy, or number two, had connectivity which was reliable enough, well, fast enough to justify it. So we thought there was little point in launching a website if most of the readers, number one, didn't know how to access it, or the line speeds were so low that it took them. There were people who were telling us that it was taking them half an hour to download a PDF. It's hard to believe, but it's true.
It's incredible, isn't it? Yep.
So number one, we had to convince ourselves that there was the internet and people's use of the service had got to a stage which would justify us starting a business. So we reached that level early 2011, and James and I both left Rural Press. James was a former national sheep rider and chief of staff, and we both departed from our previous employment, which we'd been there for a very long time, and spent the early stages of 2011 constructing, designing, building our current website, or the first of our current websites. And we pulled the trigger on that on the 11th of May, 2011. So we're coming up for our 15th birthday next May. So time flies. It's incredible that that we've been doing this that long now. And, you know, there's almost a generation now of young people, obviously, who have grown up with no knowledge of what life was like prior to the internet. So
yes,
for our older readers, you know, one of the things we were concerned about was, will we only attract a young audience because of their a little bit more internet savvy? Well, exactly the opposite was the case. We were constantly surprised by people in the bush in their 70s and 80s that absolutely embraced it, because they realised very quickly that they could get the information in Cloncurry as quickly as somebody could in Pitt Street, Sydney. And that was a new concept to them altogether. So we were surprised by how rapidly the uptake happened when we pulled the trigger on it. We orchestrated our launch day with what was a very significant piece of news at the time for the purpose of trying to attract as much attention to the site as we could. Yes. And that was the merger between Cargill and Tees. And Tees were incredibly supportive of what we were doing, and in fact orchestrated the signature of their contracts to align with the day that we pulled the trigger on launching Beef Central.
Is that right?
It is. And so day one we came out with that news, and it just spread like wildfire. I think we had 5,000 or 6,000 subscribers within 24 hours. So we were up and running.
Fantastic. Yeah. I guess it was people often talk about Kodak in industry, and there was such a change that company didn't adapt well. I guess the evolution to that online journalism was similar in a lot of ways, wasn't it?
Look, it was. And we don't want to disparage in any way friends that still produce a good quality printed newspaper every week. We think there's niches for everybody. It's just that we see our niche, which is about low cost, really, because it costs an awful lot of money to produce a printed newspaper in terms of production costs, distribution costs. Just the newsprint alone these days is an incredible fee. Our costs are so low with what we do. It's literally an internet access cost every week, and that's really it. So, you know, I wouldn't want to be burdened with the sort of cost structures that printed newspapers have. And so, but we very much see a role for printed newspapers, and I think they'll still be here in 20 years' time, to tell you the truth, for those people who like the tangible effect of picking up a newspaper. I myself, by a weekend Australian, every Saturday morning, I just love the feel and the layout and the design of a newspaper. I wouldn't want to read it every day, but on a Saturday, I just love picking up a big newspaper.
Isn't it great? That's good. I've often wondered when you were sitting there with James and you might have been having the pub chat, look, we think we can do this. Did you have a vision it would go as well as it has?
It's an interesting question, because James was doing trying to do a business course while we were launching Beef Central. One of his projects as part of that course was developing a business concept, and he basically produced a template for what Beef Central was going to be in written form, which we've been able to refer back to with the benefit of hindsight. It's clear to us now that what we were envisaging then was going to be nowhere near as significant as what it has ultimately grown into, particularly growing horizontally as we have into things like Sheep Central, Grain Central, Carbon Central. You know, we've been able to spread our wings a little more widely than just the original product. But no, I'd have to say, and even in terms of things like, we're completely surprised by the extent of overseas readership of our sites. I mean, Beef Central regularly gets 35,000 visits from overseas every month.
Is that right? Yeah. 35,000.
Yeah. And we had no idea that would be the case. With that comes great responsibility, though, because we feel an obligation to be careful that we're not giving our competitors overseas some form of intel advantage or whatever that might negatively impact on the Australian industry. But yeah, it's certainly, you know, the model itself has not changed much in 15 years. You know, we're fundamentally doing the same thing today that we did in May 2011 when we launched the business. It didn't need to be redirected in any significant way from what we can see.
No, very interesting. How did you, it's really a go-to source now. So anyone in the industry like myself, if we want to know what's going on, you're one of those first ports of call we'll go to. How did you position it to have that real trusted integrity source and get your nose in front? Was it purposeful?
Yeah, look, we always had James and I both shared a belief in the need for quality journalism. And I think every journalist that may ever speak to is going to say the same thing. But our basic mantra has always been a simple phrase, and that is content is king. And as long as you look after the content on a website like ours, everything else will look after itself. Readers will follow. Advertising will follow. Because our business is somewhat different than others in the agricultural publishing space. Our income comes solely from one source, that is paid advertising, from goods and service providers to the industry, and you've kindly seen fit to support our business through Angus Australia, as have many of your members. So we don't charge anybody for access. There's no paywall, there's no subscription, because in our mind, the best thing we can do for our advertisers is to provide them with eyeballs. So if you put up a paywall or a subscription, you're reducing the size of your audience, often dramatically. So in order to provide the best possible service for our advertisers, we've kept our sites free. And I think we may be the only large national publisher these days that does that. But we firmly believe that that's the right course for our business model, because it gives us the maximum audience size. And, you know, coming back to content is king, that means you've got to continue to produce quality content on a daily basis, not just once, But each day you've got to produce content which is both newsworthy, timely, is well-informed, is fair and balanced. So it's got to tick a few boxes. And we're constantly drilling into our younger staff members the need to try to attain those sort of qualities in what they write. Because the readers aren't silly. They will very quickly see through a clickbait headline or a statement designed to try to attract attention to an article where the content doesn't deliver on what the premise of the article is about. I think you can do that once or twice. It's a bit like crying wolf. You can get away with it once or twice. Pretty quickly, readers will wake up.
People see through it, don't they?
They will see through it. And it's in the age of modern journalism, social media based, one of the things I fear is we're drifting towards this type of content. It's all about trying to capture people's attention because it's a very crowded marketplace these days. As I say, when I started, there was one agricultural paper in each state in most cases. Now, people are gathering news from countless sources.
Yeah,
real. Auctions Plus, Elders, you know, social media. There is just a plethora of sources of news. I think it's very quickly getting to a point, though, where the typical cattle producer, which is by far the biggest part of our readership base, are getting to a point where they're looking to try to distill down where they get their news from. They're not looking for more sources. They're looking for less. But they want to know the ones they go to, they can rely on.
That's it. And on that, John, you've got a bit of a reputation for sniffing out a story. And sometimes people might say you sense it before it's even a story to sniff out. So that's quite a reputation. And how does that work? How do you go about that? Is it relationships or it's one of your strengths as a journalist?
It absolutely is. It's about contacts, cultivating and maintaining contacts with people in each sector of the industry that you feel are well informed, are prepared to share. And in the old days of journalism, this was called rounds, which referred to just gathering a collection of people in different parts of the industry to engage with. Just ring up and have a chat every couple of weeks. There's an unfortunate trend in modern journalism, and it's evident in agriculture as it is in other fields, where people are relying on social media to source their news. The problem with that is, as countless surveys have shown, social media can be very unreliable, number one. It also means if you're not careful, all the media outlets are producing the same story. Original content is absolutely critically important, and that relies on, it's old school. Scott, this what I'm talking about here is very old school, and it traces back to the very earliest origins of journalism, but it's about talking to people face-to-face, not so much face-to-face, but on a regular basis.
Yes.
And then picking up those pulses of things that are significant, because it's very easy for people who lack experience in the field to be told something that they don't pick up the significance of. And, you know, you start drawing the dots, piecing together one piece of information with another, which can affect something else, and it almost becomes a domino effect. That takes experience. It also takes what I like to refer to as historical perspective. You know, all of these things take time. It's not something you can instill in somebody overnight. But having historical perspective, I think, is critically important in a lot of agriculture because you can learn from what's happened in the past and apply from what's happening today and more or less draw some conclusions about what it might mean for tomorrow. So the quicker a young journalist can get to understand, follow, and then over a period establish some historical perspective, the better.
I had a smile the other day, John, one of your other journalists that works for you, and the name escapes me, but he gave me a call and I had a little smile because he was having a chat and he was obviously working on a story. He told me about that and he was just looking for background and he rang a few of us in the industry to get a bit of background. I thought, oh, that's a bit of a John trait there, and good to see your team are doing. So you obviously are mentoring your
very much
other journalists and to the, in inverted commas, old-fashioned journalism, but it's probably not old-fashioned journalism. It's good. It's good journalism.
I think it's so easy to dismiss processes and, you know, techniques and things that have applied in the past as being old school and not necessarily having relevance for today. But I think there's some of these processes being developed for a reason, and they are as applicable today as they ever were. But because of social media and some of these other influences, I think people are taking an easy way out.
Mm. John, I've often thought that your contact list and your phone must be one of the biggest in the industry, because we do all feel that we know John fairly well, but you must have a plethora of people that feel that way and that you can pick up the phone and have a chat. Yeah, how do you, must be humbling, I guess, is it to have such a wide network at times of people from every type of walk in the industry?
Look, it is, but for our business, we very early in the piece, we decided that we didn't want to just talk about beef production. We quickly learned that cattle producers are vitally interested in what happens beyond the farm gate. Now, that could be down to something like what's happening at retail or what's happening in packaging or some new, you know, in the use of plate freezers in terms of export performance and shelf life. There's genuine interest by producers in things beyond the farm gate. So that's made our challenge even more difficult, because we need to establish contacts in the meat processing field, in the export field, in areas like value adding, in the supermarket and wholesale meat trade, beyond simple cattle production, seed stock production, genetics, pastures, the things that apply in a more sort of intimate and immediate sense for beef producers. But so that's been a challenge, but you know, we see that as a key part of our output, is that it is through chain. It's not just about what's happening in the paddock.
Yeah, we can see that from the outside. How many beef producers do you think you might connect with through you in Australia? Have you ever sat down to try and work that out? You'd have a list.
Yeah, we do. You'd
know the number of
beef. There's roughly 50,000 beef producers in Australia, depending which set of data you try to extract this from. So it's not a particularly big group. Of course, there's a lot of layers, because we think of our readership like a pyramid. The bottom layer is beef producers. The next level above that are people like lot feeders, and then you get a smaller part of the pyramid still with processors, exporters, and then you plug in people like involved in regulatory, government personnel, people involved in extension, research, advisory, professional people, accountants, solicitors. All of those groups are significant, but the beef producing part of the pyramid is by far the largest. There are certain metrics which apply to digital publishing, which we don't particularly put a lot of faith in. Yeah. But I don't mind sharing with you. The unique browsers coming to Beef Central, which is our largest platform, often go past 200,000 per month and have been as high as 300,000. We are somewhat cynical about the size of that. That's different people.
Yes.
That's different people visiting the site per month. To a large extent, the biggest portion of those people are irrelevant to what we're producing. What we want to know is, are we getting to the 50,000 beef producers that are actively engaged in the industry, and a cohort that sit above them in that pyramid that I described earlier? And we think we're getting a pretty good penetration into that, into that part of the market. Very difficult to be absolutely specific, and as I say, digital publishing numbers can give you some very flaky figures just because of the sheer size of them.
Interesting. So we've got, you'd have a pretty good penetration of those beef producers and industry professionals. You got, it's one of the most interesting characters you've come across in your walk, John. You'll have met some characters in the industry.
We've met a lot of very interesting characters, you know, over the years. And I think the industry is blessed by having those sort of people who are larger than life personalities. People like Monty Adkinson was a very early pioneer drought master. Well, he was the founder of the drought master breed. And I have fond memories of meeting Monty as a very old man in his early days. There's been so many to sort of single one out. It would probably be unfair to the others, but I don't know if we've got quite the depth of those larger-than-life personalities in the industry today. Or maybe they're just not allowed to express themselves. But
social media might have killed us.
Yeah, I think so. I think people have to sort of play by the rules a little more these days, which is a little bit of a shame. But there's been some very, you know, people, I'm thinking of Ted Cunningham, for example, who was a beef producer from Strathmore near Collinsville. And Ted was a bush pilot of the roughest of, I think he had seven or eight aircraft crashes over his over his career and landing planes, you know, on roads in pitch black darkness and all sorts of crazy exploits that he got up to. But, you know, people like that, just, I don't know if they would make it in the industry and in the society today, but certainly they were out there all those years ago.
Yeah, interesting. We can't wait for your memoirs one day, John. So you're a journalist that nearly have to write a pretty good memoir. You've also, as part of this business, you've got your own podcast. You've got an interesting team around. You're having a bit you do on the grill with Kerry Lonergan. It's been very successful. How's it fit into your business? Yeah. What part does it play?
So, for the first 7 or 8 years of the Beef Central business, we concentrated just on doing the core business, which is basically putting text onto a digital page with a photo or two, a website-based news dissemination service. But as time has gone by, some of these other platforms have become a lot more important, and particularly for young people. I think there's a lot of young people that want to source their news and markets intelligence, and as well as their social lives, but they want to use other platforms, whether it be Facebook or not so much Twitter anymore. I think Twitter has pretty much run its race, Instagram. So we've felt the need to explore other ways to disseminate information. Webinars is one we've had some great success with. The podcast, which we now conduct 2 every week. Kerry Lonergan, who had 40 years as the producer of Landline, retired from ABC. And I always say to Kerry, you're a brand in your own right. Everybody in the bush knows Kerry Lonergan. I said, what are we going to do with you? You know, you can't just drift off and play bowls or bridge. He's a mad keen bridge player. He's actually a competitive bridge player, believe it or not, yeah. And I said, we've got to do something with you, Kerry. What are we going to do? So he said, let's do a podcast. So we're now in our 5th year of podcast that Kerry produces. So that's a long form podcast with one subject. All he does is explore an industry stakeholder, talks to them in depth about their opinions about what's, you know, hitting their buttons and things in the industry. That's been very successful. I mean, it depends very much on the topic and who the person is, but we can get 4,000 downloads on a good one, on a good podcast like that. The reason I think why our podcasts have been successful is we have a platform to put that podcast out of in front of an audience through our websites. We see a lot of podcasts that struggle for audience because they don't really have a way. You know, I think people fall for the trap with podcasts of, I use the term, build it and they will come.
Yes.
Doesn't necessarily apply.
Yeah, I think you're right.
You've got to have a good product and be able to put it out in front of an audience. So this year we've started a new podcast, which is called The Week in Beef, which is effectively a little snapshot of the big news items of the week. And we're fortunate amongst our young staff members, we have 2 excellent former ABC rural radio employees who are very comfortable in front of a microphone and deliver a much, much more polished performance than myself or probably James would ever produce. So they're doing a great job. We've still got our training wheels on with that, but it's really a snapshot of what we think are the big ticket items in the beef industry this week. And you look, it's great, it's going well. The other format I really like is webinars. For one key reason, you drill in on a topic of interest across the broader industry, you put that out as a webinar for those people that are interested. They can either listen to it on the spot, live, or get a recorded version to listen to later on. The thing I like particularly about webinars is the interactivity, the ability for those listeners, and we've had webinars with up to 600 people on them, which, you know, we're very happy with, but it's that ability for the presenter and his subject to engage with the audience live. It's almost like being in the room, which other platforms really don't deliver. Sure, people can put comments on the bottom of articles or on the bottom of YouTube clips or whatever, but it's not the same. You lose that spontaneity. And I just love the webinar concept. I think there's a lot of scope to do more with it, which it's probably only time that sort of limits us from engaging with that. But I think particularly for young people, they're sourcing their information from a whole range of sources where people of your and my vintage got a more probably aligned with, you know, a website or yes, a newspaper.
Yeah. Oh, mate, I'd completely agree. We've had quite good success at Angus with our webinars for particular sort of technical presentations of information as well.
And particularly that you can put on screen as well. You know, you can actually have a show some graphs and charts and things. And so, for that reason, I think webinars has a big future that probably hasn't yet been fully exploited.
John, you get across, I guess, the whole industry. What do you think are the three top issues that we're going to face in the beef industry and grapple with going forward?
It's a good question, and I wish you'd asked me what are the top 20, because I think I could probably fill that list pretty easily. The three that come to mind with me, the first is solving this problem the industry's been cursed with the last 50 years about the relationship between producers and processors. There's been lots of talk about it. There's been periods when, you know, there's been some serious attempts to try to sort of engage with this. I think we've made progress, because there's a lot of people now aligned with particular brand programs, certain supply chains, and the payoff for that is better feedback and that sort of thing. But I don't think we have shaken off this adversarial sort of relationship between producers and processors.
You do hear that commentary when you're with a group of beef producers, don't you?
Yeah.
It does rise to the top a little.
It comes up in reader comments all the time. You know, it's mostly the producers throwing stones at processors, I've got to say. It's rarely happening the other way. But I suppose there's nothing to be gained by a processor having a stab at producers, because we unfortunately still suffer from these enormous swings in cattle price, whether that's because by drought or market influence or whatever. But the industry's got to find ways. And I think one of the ways that this can improve is by moving down the value-based marketing route with more vigour and more sort of serious intent. And we're sitting in the MLA office recording this podcast today, and Michael Crowley's just outside this room, and he is certainly beating the drum about the need for the industry to move towards value-based marketing. We have had some attempts at it in the past. Woolworths went close 20 years ago under the guidance of Phil Morley. They went within a whisker of pulling the trigger on a yield-based, value-based marketing program. Politics and some other factors got in the way. But I think, you know, a modern rendition of a value-based marketing program would go a lot further than just yield. And obviously meat quality is a given. There's the Kilfor data. There's the Chiller assessment data, which is a given in any value-based marketing program. Yield is number three, but there's a whole lot more that can be incorporated into this. Hides value, offals value is another important one. You know, the industry is losing that much money from condemned offals. It isn't funny. From hydatids, cysts, pleurisy, you name it. There's a million things that are producing tens and tens of millions of dollars worth of loss, many of which are preventable. Move towards a value-based marketing system, and I think the industry will be shocked at how quickly we can get on top of some of these issues.
That's good commentary. We had Michael speak to our board at a board workshop last week. Went through the five pillars of it's not five pillars any longer. They've got different terminology. But how do you think you'll go? It's a big objective, this value-based marketing. You've been around for a long time. What do you think the chances of success are?
Every year that goes by, I think they're getting better. The big deterrent is that the companies that have an appetite for it, fearful about losing business to other processors. Because if you think of the yield part of value-based marketing on its own and in isolation from everything else, it's a bell curve. So by definition, 50% of those cattle are going to be on the wrong side of the curve. So you're going to go back to your Angus beef supplier from Wandown and say, look, I'm sorry, we're going to have to pay you less for these cattle than we did last week, because your cattle are on the wrong side of the bell curve. And then what happens with those cattle? They go to the opposition. And difficult to come up with a solution unless everybody moves at once. And possibly that might happen, but I think there are challenges there in how we manage that whole move to VBM. But I look forward to the day, and I hope it happens in my lifetime, but the industry can make so much progress in areas like yield. And, you know, I think ultimately traits like feed efficiency will come into the value-based marketing field, and as they should, because it's all part of the value of an animal, and hopefully we can ultimately get to a point where we can use DNA and, you know, other traits to sort of determine cattle that are going to perform better for feed efficiency, carbon emissions, yes, all these other things. But that's on the distant horizon.
Yeah, that's right.
Let's aim for the big targets first. Let's do yield. And what an incredible opportunity there is in yield. Once we start providing feedback to your members in greater detail, to start putting a little bit of selection pressure on cattle for traits that ultimate, that currently we don't get paid for. So what is motivating people, in my opinion, to go chasing those traits unless we start, unless we can start, you know, providing some dollar signals, and that covers feed efficiency and things as well. So, you know, hopefully we'll start to move down these paths. We look at our friends in chicken and pork and how incredibly efficient those animals are to feed. The good thing is, with that, is we've still got that in our armory. We haven't played that card yet. So happy days when we do.
Yeah. We've seen, I guess, in the Angus industry, we've seen price signals that have encouraged the whole production system, really. Like in the early days, that 10-cent premium for Angus cattle in the yards. And now, look at that. Producers do respond well to price signals, don't they?
Absolutely. And what better breed to reflect that than yours? Of just reflecting on the sort of evolution of Angus, and, you know, I think a lot of it's got to do with the arrival of recognition of quality.
Yes.
And I trace this back to the liberalisation of the Japanese market in 1991. Prior to 1991, the only beef we could sell to Japan was to government-run instrumentalities. That product would then get distributed through those organisations to end users, whether it be supermarkets, restaurants or whatever. But we had no ability to engage with the end customer. Suddenly, the Japanese agreed to market liberalisation, which started in 1991. It was an absolute game changer in the sense the Japanese have always had a high regard and a recognition of quality. Prior to that, the Australian beef industry was not a quality-related industry at all. Our biggest customer by far was the United States, fundamentally for use in hamburger meat. Suddenly, we had a market in Japan where quality was significant and they were prepared to pay for it. That, in turn, led to some of the most profound changes in the beef industry in Australia. Prior to that, cattle were basically bought on dentition and weight. All of a sudden, chiller assessment through AusMeat came in, 93, I guess, and producers started getting information on a whole range of traits that they were almost oblivious to previously. One of these was marbling. Angus then obviously floated to the surface as part of that process. That led to an evolution, which we see today with things like Angus brand programs and marbling-based brand programs, which by proxy effectively means Angus. So the recognition and the appetite for customers to pay for quality has been the absolute driver of the Angus success story, which we see today.
Yeah. I was in Singapore in 96 and 97 and worked for a food company, Singapore Food Industries. There was quite a differential for Australian product behind the price of US beef at the time, because they had quality to an extent sorted out. They were on the road to it. They had marbled beef that was finished in feedlots, and there was just such a big price differential to the Australian and New Zealand product that was often just shipped frozen because there was no premium there. And it's just come such a long way.
So we carried a burden for a long time, reputational burden, because the Japanese particularly, but also in Korea, they're buying selection decisions. They said, well, the US is the source for quality meat, so we go there and get our grain fed, better quality meat. Australia would just use for manufacturing meat. So unfortunately, that reputational damage lasted for a long time after Japan liberalised in 1991, Korea 2 years later. But we really struggled to get that price recognition for a long time. No longer evident today, but for a long period, we suffered from a burden that it's from Australia, it must be lower quality, even though our shelf life is so far superior to product chilled out of the United States. It didn't matter. It's just that the US carried that reputation in those markets. And thank goodness that's now passed, because we're getting more closely rewarded for what we're producing.
Yeah, I think so. John, if we flick to the other side of the industry, you've probably got a pretty good overview of this new sustainability world that we live in. Thanks so much for listening to this first part of my conversation with John. Stay tuned for part two, where we discuss the evolving landscape of the beef industry, including sustainability and carbon, over the next 10 years and what John foresees for Angus producers and the beef industry. He also tells us a bit about his personal story, his values, and what makes him get up each morning and run Beef Central. Join us for part two. Thanks for joining us today. We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Angus Table. We look forward to bringing you more conversations that support your success in the Angus breed and your farming operation. I'm Scott Wright, CEO of Angus Australia, and today's Angus Table podcast is produced by Mel Strasberg. Until next time, all the best.